Muy buenos días a todos los
Good afternoon. I would like to welcome our auditoriums, our people who are listening to this webcast around the entire planet.
We're
meeting again today to carry out a second dialogue between the American politician and economist Lyndon LaRouche and one of the most important labor leaders of Mexico, engineer Agustín Rodríguez, who is the General Secretary of the Trade Union of Workers of the National University, Autonomous University of Mexico. From Mexico City, from the auditorium of this, which has been called the House of the People, we would like to welcome everybody from different institutions and audiences who are listening into this program. Allow me to first announce how the program is going to be carried out today. First of all, we will have a presentation by Mr. LaRouche. After that, we are going to have a presentation by Agustín Rodríguez, who is, I've been assured, about to arrive here in the auditorium in just another couple of minutes. And after that, we will have a presentation from our special invited guest, this afternoon from Dr. Yasmín Fariña of Chile. There are other groups who are watching and will be talking to us, in particular from the auditorium of the CGT, the Argentine Confederation of Workers, as well as other Argentine trade union leaders, and very probably additional groups who are listening in Lima, Peru, and also in other our parts of the continent, and we will announce this as we proceed in the course of this event. I would like to mention that in Mexico as well, there are other groups who are watching this show where there are meetings of different university, academic leaders, trade union leaders, various universities, other meeting rooms of the STUNAM unit itself who are going to participate in this dialogue, which we have called Globalization is Equal to Fascism. And we are calling also for the creation of a new international economic order along the lines that Lyndon LaRouche has proposed. We are very happy that Mr. LaRouche is with us. He's just returned from an extremely successful trip, successful for all of humanity, for the establishment of a new international political geometry. He is returning from a trip to Russia, where he was invited by the Academy of Sciences, and also from Italy, where he spoke before a special committee of the Italian Senate, where he discussed the urgency of creating this new world order in the face of the completely insane assault from the leadership in the United States, especially this entire crowd grouped around Dick Cheney, George Bush, and the economic hitmen that work for these people in different countries around the world. I would also like to announce that among those who participate in this dialogue, we will have a representative for Mr. LaRouche for Ibero-America, the economist Dennis Small. At the moment, here in the auditorium here in Mexico City, we have a number of representatives, trade union representatives from the National Autonomous University of Mexico, and, of course, representatives, members of the LaRouche Youth Movement here in Mexico. I would like to proceed now and ask Mr. Lyndon LaRouche to please make his presentation to us, and we want to hear what he has to say to us today on the subject which we have proposed today for today's meeting. So, Mr. LaRouche, welcome from Mexico City, and we're listening to you with great attention. Please proceed.
Well, thank you very much. As Dennis said, I just recently returned from Europe from an important discussion in Moscow on the occasion of the birthday of a leading economist, his 80th birthday, and this involved also my presentation of interviews on television and elsewhere in other locations there in Moscow, which were of some significance. That was followed by my actually three-day visit in Mexico, where I addressed the defense special committee, the defense the Senate, on some of these issues, and also had a number of discussions of similar relevance.
The significance is this. We are in one of the most exciting and dangerous periods of modern history. The present world monetary financial system will inevitably disappear soon. The question is, what will replace it? That's the issue. The international monetary system in its present form is hopelessly bankrupt. There's no way it could be simply reformed. It must be, in a sense, replaced. So what has to be done, essentially, is we have to create a new monetary system. And what I've proposed is this, that if the United States, and this is not impossible, if the United States should extend a proposal to Russia, to China, and to India to co-sponsor the formation of a new international monetary financial order, that could be done. The problem is that most nations, such as those of Western and Central Europe and other parts of the world, are not able to independently act in this way, to initiate. However, if you get the United States and Russia, which are two of the largest nations of the developed world, formerly developed world, and you combine that with China and India, which are the two Asian nations which represent the largest ration of population, of the world's population, then you have a combination which can provide a protective cover for joint action together with the nations of South America, for example, and Europe and elsewhere. That's our only real chance we have. Now, it's not impossible that the United States could be induced to do that, even under present conditions. At present, we have, of course, Dick Cheney is highly vulnerable. And what you've had a recent development since my return from Europe, which is the so-called BAE scandal, which involves someone known to some of you, Pinochet, who's now gone, but his relics are there. Pinochet was a part of this scandal. And he, of course, was a fascist. He was sponsored by certain people in the United States, as well as from London. And he became, in his last years of life, virtually a British agent, openly. George Shultz in California, who was one of the sponsors of putting the Pinochet dictatorship into power, together with Felix Rohatyn, a banker of fascist proclivities, who was the key banker in this operation, and, of course, Henry Kissinger then functioned in support of that in terms of as his role as Secretary of State. So this is the character. Now, what's happening is this. BAE represents essentially a British imperial institution, which has grabbed more and more power in various parts of the world and has attempted to gain more and more control over the United States. What has happened now is that Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, who has been a long-standing asset of these circles, has been exposed as part of this operation. We have now an incalculable crisis worldwide in progress. This is not a financial crisis. This is not a financial scandal as such. This is not a scandal of any ordinary sense. This is a crisis to see who is going to run the world. Is it going to be a group of nations, or is it going to be the emerging new British Empire, or the re-emergent British Empire, which really never went away, which takes over from the United States and establishes its world rule through globalization? And, for example, with BAE, which is an instrument for taking control of the military capabilities of the world under a British imperial organization, a quasi-private organization, but an imperial organization. Now, we've had recently in South America some very interesting and positive developments. We've had partly on the initiative of what has happened from Argentina, which was crucial in this, we've had a bringing together of the nations of South America in what is not a consolidated but is a very promising option. And it is part of the is part of the solution. Therefore, what we have to do is this. The present world international monetary financial system is bankrupt. There is no way in which it could be reformed on its own terms and survive. Any attempt to maintain this system would mean a complete disintegration into a new dark age comparable to what Europe experienced during the 14th century with the collapse of some of the Lombard banks in Italy at that time. That would happen. Therefore, the solution is to establish a new international monetary financial system. That can be done on the basis of the U.S. Constitution's special provisions. Remember, the U.S. system is not a monetarist system. The U.S. system constitutionally is based on a credit system based on the constitutional authority of the United States government over the control, utterance and control of its own money. In other parts of the world, countries' financial systems have been controlled largely under the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, in which this system, through its network of private banks, so-called central banks, actually dictates and controls governments. So we've had an imperial world monetary financial system, which has been traditionally centered on the British Empire, essentially ever since February 1763. Against that, the only system which is surviving of any great significance today as the alternative is the constitutional provisions of the U.S. Constitution, which establishes the U.S. dollar as a credit mechanism of the U.S. government. That is, under our system, when it's operating, and it has not always operated that way, obviously, under our system, we generate credit through a vote in the Congress, especially the House of Representatives. The President of the United States then acts upon that authority of this federal law to utter currency as credit against the United States itself. Now, the chief function of this credit is not just to print money. The function of this credit is to supply capital funds for long-term capital investments, especially in the public sector, but spilling over into the private sector. In the public sector, large-scale infrastructure projects for the states as well as the federal government. This credit generally extends for a life period of 25 to 50 years in terms of modern economy. Therefore, we have a present world monetary financial system which does not function. However, if the United States affirms its constitution and enters into agreement with three other sponsoring major countries and other countries, then we can create a new international monetary financial system immediately, putting the entire existing system into bankruptcy reorganization to maintain the continuity of essential functions and to start a program of actual net economic growth and development. The hard core of this, or the long term, would be long-term investment in basic economic infrastructure and development of the economies of various parts of the world. A cooperative set of treaty agreements of 25 to 50 years duration to create capital formation to bring the world up in the way that Roosevelt had intended had he lived at the end of the war, the last war. So that's what our option is. If we do that, we can get out of the present mess. If we do not make such a reform, there is no hope for civilization. Chaos would be inevitable. There's no part of the world that could withstand the chain reaction effects of a collapse of the U.S. economy now. The collapse of the U.S. dollar would mean a collapse of all dollars and every claims against the dollar in every part of the world. It would bankrupt China, it would bankrupt India, it would bankrupt Europe. So even at the present time, there's no way that the United States could collapse and the rest of the world escape. Not possible. Therefore, the United States must be reformed in the way, consistent with its own constitution, by offering cooperation with other countries, especially leading countries, to establish a new world system, a new version of the old Bretton Woods system, which would provide for a recovery programs of over 25 to 50 years of long-term investment throughout the world as a whole. For example, you have the case in South America. We have this Bank of the South, which has now emerged, a very positive development. Such a bank, if it were operating under the protection and assistance of such an international reform, would be capable of generating its own version of long-term credit internally within South America for necessary, obviously necessary projects. We have a fragile situation in South America, some very good agreements, but a lot of problems. And therefore, we must resolve those problems by finding a positive, common positive solution which brings people together about the options for good, that is, for benefits, as opposed to simply fighting each other, quarreling over differences. And this is possible. This is the situation we face now. On the U.S. situation, the BAE crisis, the scandal involving the British arms industry, or the arms monopoly, this is not, as I said before, this is not simply a monetary crisis or a scandal. This is a contest between two systems, the human race and the British Empire. What is involved here is a institution of the British monarchy, the BAE, which is being used to take over the military affairs of the world. That is, as a monopoly of military power. This is accompanied at the time that we have, coming out of the United States and Britain, a policy which is associated with the name of Dick Cheney, from the time he was formerly the Secretary of Defense and now is Vice President. He's the virtually acting President of the United States today. This policy, which is supported by the familiar George Shultz, who remembered for his backing of Pinochet, is called a revolution in military affairs. The objective is to establish a world empire of military power. The empire would be based on eliminating the regular ground military forces, that is, national military forces, and replacing these with private armies which replace these forces. But at the same time, to control the planet through putting weapons in space which can drop missiles from space on any part of the world that the ruling authorities do not approve of, and with using the naval power in a diminishing role for the same effect. We're looking at the threat of a world empire, a new British empire, in fact. And what has happened with this crisis about BAE is certain forces in Europe, including inside the United Kingdom and in the United States, are now in a state of revolt against this threat of world empire. It is expressed partly by the resistance from leading military figures in the United States and elsewhere against what is going on in Southwest Asia today. It is expressed in other ways, and it's expressed in the BAE scandal. The blowing of the scandal, the identification of Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia as a key figure in this international swindle, has blown open the whole issue. If Bandar goes down, then the whole system would tend to go down. And there are many people in the United States, and also some in the United Kingdom, as well as in Europe, who would welcome this immediately. So now we're at a point where the old system has collapsed. A rotten system which has been in existence in this form since 1971, since the summer of 1971. This system has now collapsed. There's no possibility that the present world monetary financial system can continue to exist in its present form. The date on which it would die is uncertain, but the inevitability of its early death is absolutely certain. Therefore, we have to choose a new world system. This is the case for the people in London and elsewhere who are for or behind what the BAE scandal represents, those who are looking for a one-world empire, for globalization. That's a new form of world empire. We, on the other hand, have an option. If the United States plays the role for which it was intended at the time it was created as a federal republic and allies with nations around the world to bring together a coalition of nations whose tradition is European, whose tradition in other cases is Eurasian, that is, like Russia is a Eurasian nation, not a nation, and not a European nation. It has European roots, but it also has Asian roots in its culture. Then you have the great Asian cultures, represented by China, India, and so forth, and other large countries of Asia. The objective on this planet should have been, for a long time, to find a way of bringing these three sectors of the world together in some form of cooperation. The European culture, as represented in its best sense by what the United States has achieved by freeing itself of oligarchical traditions, what by Russia is typical of the Eurasian group of nations, that is, who represent both Asian cultures and European cultures, and those Asian cultures, such as China, India, and so forth. If we can bring these great cultures together in a program of recovery of the planet as a whole, the following is the case. We now have a project online, which has recently been boosted by in Russia, a project which I've been supporting a long time, is to build a tunnel, a railway tunnel, from Siberia to Alaska. Now, what this would do would be lead to a global change in the character of human relations on this planet. It would mean that we would have high-speed rail or magnetic levitation transport systems coming from Europe into not just Alaska, but down through the entire Americas. We have intended this for a long time, to have a complete rail system connecting the north of North America to the southern tip of South America. By going through a similar way through Southwest Asia and across from Europe into Africa, we now would have a way in the immediate future, not necessarily in my lifetime, but beyond, immediate future of which we can unite the major parts of the planet of this planet together in new form of economic cooperation as sovereign nation states linked by high-speed rail transport or magnetic levitation transport. We would then have changed the world from one dominated by sea power to one dominated by the development on landed areas, of populated landed areas. This great change now stands before us. We have new technologies, new fundamental technologies, like nuclear efficient power, which is needed to deal with the water problems of much of the world, freshwater problems, and for power in general. We have new technologies of thermonuclear fusion technologies, which are significant because they provide new kinds of isotopes that we can manufacture in large degree for various kinds of needs, as well as a source of power. We have the project of great projects of transportation and other kinds of great projects to rebuild the planet as a whole through a system of cooperation among sovereign nation states who are largely linked together by international high-speed rail or magnetic levitation routes. To take every part of the world, including the most remote parts of Africa, and desperate parts of Africa, to bring them together in a common world system, a system of sovereign nation states. And that's where we are today. And therefore, on the one hand, I'm optimistic as to what can be done, what must be done. I'm fearful of what will happen to humanity if we don't do it. What we have in South America, in particular, in the attempt to bring some cooperation among the states of the continent of South America, is extremely important because it sets a model for nations which have completely different kinds of special problems. Like the problems of Bolivia are not the same as those of Brazil. They're related. The problems of Colombia, the problems of Argentina. These are all different kinds of economies. With apparently conflicting interests, but they have an overriding common interest. And therefore, we have to take nations which have conflicting requirements and bring them together around the idea of a common purpose, a common goal for mankind. And this Bank of the South operation, which has emerged in South America, is key. The nations of South America do have the right, the implicit right, to set up their own credit system, their own international banking arrangements among sovereign nations, to create large-scale credit, and to regulate their relations with one another, with the idea that, based on the Westphalian principle, that is, that each nation shall consider the welfare of the other nation as its paramount concern. And if all nations look at matters in this way, we don't have a problem in cooperation. the Westphalian principle. So the time has come where we have the worst crisis in modern history, you know, a crisis which goes probably worse than some of the problems of the Dark Ages of Europe. We're coming to the limit. We have a financial system which cannot be saved. There's no way of functioning under the existing monetary financial system of the world. Can't do it. We have a crisis where the system is threatened with coming down in various ways. The crisis of the BAE crisis is typical of this. And on the other hand, we have the possibility, on the basis of experience and desires of people of conscience in many nations, to bring nations together around a new monetary system, more or less consistent with the intention of Franklin Roosevelt at the close of World War II, to build a new world monetary system based on a credit system rather than a predatory monetary system, a monetarist system. We have specific projects and technologies which are either developed or could be developed, which can address most of the problems. We can bring together the entirety of the planet on the basis of the same principle celebrated in the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. It's time to go back to that. So that's my message for the moment.
Muchísimas gracias, señor LaRouche.
Thank you very much, Mr. LaRouche. I would like to remind everyone who is listening internationally that we are involved in a second international dialogue between Lyndon LaRouche, the economist and politician of the United States, and Agustin Rodriguez, the Secretary General of the Trade Union of Workers of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. And we greet him. He has been here with us for some good time now here in this auditorium. And I would therefore like to mention that questions can be sent over the Internet. Send it to the mail preguntas@larouchepub.com. That for the entire world audience that would like to send in questions, both of Mr. LaRouche as well as to engineer Agustin Rodriguez. So we have the honor and the pleasure of presenting Agustin Rodriguez for him to speak about what the problems of this globalism that it has brought to Mexico. In particular, here in Mexico, a law was approved privatizing Social Security, Social Security of state sector workers. And this law completely violates any concept of dignity that workers have. Agustin Rodriguez, as a leader of the university, but also at the trade union of the university, but also as a component group of the UNT Trade Union Confederation, has been carrying out a series of activities to denounce these violations of workers' rights and the really anti-democratic nature, this fascist type reform which is being imposed in Mexico and across the continent today. Of course, our special invited guest, Yasmin Fariña of Chile, and others, international people from Argentina and Peru, will also talk about these issues, this aspect of globalization in Ibero-America. So without further ado, I'd like to please invite engineer Agustin Rodriguez to come to the podium and address us today.
Muchas gracias, muy buenas tardes.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I've arrived slightly late to this conference, and I would like to apologize for that. But today was an important day for us because of the demands which we have been making, the protests as the UNT, and more specifically as the STUNAM trade union, protests with regard to this new law which has been imposed recently on state sector workers, and which totally changes the context, the social and economic context that the workers face, especially, principally, in terms of their social security, what they get for social security here in Mexico. Today, We got a response from the Labor Ministry of Mexico, response to a document which we gave them 8 days ago. We gave it to Javier Lozano, the Labor Minister of Mexico, in which we presented and we documented the violations which were being made of the Constitution of Mexico, violations which are implicit in the law which was approved back on March 30th. And today they answered us, and we have not yet analyzed it from a legal standpoint, and we are going to continue with our work. Now, here it's very important to turn to the subject of globalization. If economic globalization were good for all human beings, we would be seeing general benefits on a global scale. However, there's something about economic globalization, which is that the only thing that has happened as a result of it, and this is the case not only in Mexico, but just about in every country around the world, it has increased the poverty of the citizens. It has also reduced their income levels of all workers. And that is something which has to be analyzed in upcoming conferences and actions which we will be carrying out, because it's not just a question of having a policy position opposed to the free market economic system, but rather we're opposed to a policy which has been producing the impoverishment of millions of Mexicans. If we look at our situation here in Mexico, if we look back two presidential terms ago, 12 years ago, we had 18 million Mexicans who were living under conditions of poverty. Today, 50 million Mexicans. And of these 50 million, 20 million are in extreme poverty or indigents. At this moment in our country, there are a lot of parts of the country where education is not available in an adequate way. There's no quality education for all the inhabitants of the country, even though there is a constitutional provision, social provision of tremendous impact, which establishes that the state provides obligatory and quality education for all Mexicans. But we don't have that. As a result of that economic system which has produced so much economic inequality, we find students who don't even have a place to be able to even get basic education. And that is something which has been happening. Another area of impact, education is not really supported. It is not given the support that it requires from the federal executive branch. Every year we have to fight for them not to cut back the budget. This year, in the previous presidential administration, the previous president, President Fox, achieved the impossible. He managed to get the general budget for education to drop by 0.2% compared to the previous presidential term. And that gives you an idea of their concept. Then if we turn to the issue of food consumption and food production in the agricultural sector, we have a tremendous deficit, a developmental deficit, as a result of the agreements which were reached through the North American Free Trade Accord, NAFTA, where here the beneficiaries, it is not we Mexicans, we are not benefiting. It is the other side of the equation, because they are the ones who have tremendous economic capabilities for subsidizing their products, the products produced in their countryside, in their agricultural sector, and they do so with millions of dollars. Here in Mexico, we just have a couple of million pesos for those subsidies. The United States is actually violating that NAFTA agreement because it's prohibited to subsidize agriculture, yet the United States is doing this in a really cynical fashion, because what this does is that it encourages inequality in the generation of free trade. So therefore, we have a lot of products from our countryside, or our agricultural products, which come in from abroad. They come here to Mexico, and many here in Mexico, which just have to be thrown away because they rot, because they are warehoused, and no one buys these products because they're more expensive than what is dumped from abroad. As a result, agricultural production in Mexico is not developing. If there's no development of the countryside and of agricultural products and of food in Mexico, we find the other aspect of the economy, which I want to mention, which is that the feedstocks for animals, of animals which are used themselves for food, which are used for food by the human race, animals who consume transgenic agricultural products, which they say are generating them, but although this has not been demonstrated, but what is a fact is that we're facing a lot of diseases which we didn't previously, and these are now developing, especially in countries such as Mexico, because of the consumption of feedstocks which are developed under this agricultural process of the transgenic crops. Now, let me turn to the social aspect of this, which is the final point I want to mention. Social Security in Mexico has functioned under a scheme, a system which its name says it. It's a social in nature. Now, what's happening today is that accounts are being individualized and privatized. We are having a situation where medical services are being privatized, and this is a path to the economy of free market economy, supply and demand system, for pensions and retirement funds, and for medical services. We are convinced that the fight being waged by our trade union and others as well is not a fight which will end today or tomorrow. It's a long-term battle, which is not only part of the broader phase of the fight against this new law, the ISSSTE law, which has been imposed, but it is part of a fight against this, which has been identified as structural reforms of the entire system. And those structural reforms are what are being pushed in Mexico to generate an even greater exploitation, a greater enrichment of the owners of capital. There is a tax reform which is underway, being proposed, and there's also a labor reform which is being discussed. On this labor reform, there is one article which the business layers really want to change. This is Article 35, which establishes the ways, the mechanisms for hiring by which the businessmen can hire the workers. That means of hiring is the idea of temporary workers or hiring as apprentices. That form of hiring in the 60s and 70s led to an enormous exploitation of the workers, such that in 1971, we managed to reform that article, and we eliminated that form of exploitation, that kind of hiring of workers in Mexico. Now, that's the same subject which they want to reopen. Why? To be able to create so-called flexibilization in the hiring of workers, which will eliminate Social Security absolutely and completely, no benefits, collective contracts, trade unions, because with this kind of temporary hiring for 3 months, 4 months, And with such a large supply of unemployed labor, clearly today they'll hire a worker, and in 3 years they'll hire the same guy all over again. And that will destroy any kind of Social Security and any defense of the interests of workers. There was a very good debate which we were involved in the last legislature, and we were able to deal with this in the Labor Committee of that Congress, and we managed to ensure that that did not go ahead in the last legislative session. But that's the nodal point, the central point of the legislation they want, because that would allow them to flexibilize any kind of hiring. Even worse, the idea of hiring for apprenticeship, which becomes a merit-based system, so that somebody comes and says, well, I'm going to come here and work to learn, but I'm not going to be paid, or give me just a little bit. And this will just lead to even further exploitation of workers. We're totally opposed to this. We have said, and we're quite convinced, that the structural reforms that are being proposed, are being pushed, so that Mexican workers and Mexican society accept as a condition to be able to open and create development in the country, supposedly, this is a fallacy. This is totally contrary to the interests of development of Mexicans, because it's been shown that where these type of schemes have been applied, there has not been advance, there has not been any development, and there has not been the generation, no reduction in the social injustice gap which the economic neoliberal system has created. And that's where we want all of these aspects to be rediscussed, reopened. The path of lack of equity, lack of equilibrium, lack of development, lack of fair conditions. I'm convinced that the only way, the only formula to be able to develop in a country, and this is not something which I'm inventing, but which has happened in developing sector countries, and people always protect this. They're always careful to be able to maintain and to keep moving forward step by step, and that is to protect their internal market. If you protect your internal market, you encourage employment, you take care of health, food, nutrition, education of the population. In this case, our internal market has been completely destroyed. It has been made subject, our entire economy, 70% subject to foreign interests, depends completely on what happens in foreign markets. Now, this is not counterposed, because we can develop in the foreign markets, because we do have to participate and encourage all the exports imaginable, but we must here defend the internal market first and foremost. That's what the United States does. That's what France does. That's what they do in many countries around the world. And that's the key to the differences, the disagreements that we have with those of us who are not in agreement with this formula, this pragmatic formula of bringing things from abroad, impose these goods here in the country, and then tell us this is generosity, charity, goodness. Yeah, sure, but just for a few people. And so just simple exercise. Take a look at our country. Our country is at the verge of having the first billionaire, trillionaire on a world scale. What does that mean, to have the first trillionaire? It means that we have tremendous poverty. I don't want to compare ourselves in the scheme of things to countries in Africa in terms of starvation, but there are parts of the country where that's happening. We're not far away from going into a situation with that kind of impact. If there's no production of food in the country, if there's no generation of employment, if there's no dignified salaries, because only owners of capital have decent income. So in the final analysis, what we have here is something that cannot be understood except in one way. Yes, there is wealth production, but for just a few. Only a few benefit from it. And that's why this neoliberal economic model has to be reviewed, reformed to stop the generation of poverty and impoverishment which is going on. This is something that we've been working on as a trade union, not just recently. We warned about this in 1985 when the imposition began of this neoliberal economic model, and where we presented a diagnosis of what could happen if we did not act on time. 1985, that was, during the period of which was the supposed golden age of a pre-government, of the pre-party, which encouraged the imposition of this neoliberal economic system. And everything which is happening now, and which the two ultimate governments have followed on, without question, they're following the exact same program. And what we said back in 1985 in a full-page advertisement, the destiny of Mexico is being lost. We have to change our course. What is going to happen when everything that we said there is what's now happening in our country? We diagnosed the situation back then. Unfortunately, in the trade union movement in general in Mexico, we have not yet found enough perception or sensibility to be able to create a broad front with three or four central objectives so that as a great trade union mass of people, we can carry out. I'm completely convinced that the only people who can change the path of Mexico in this country, it is we, the organized workers of the country, those who generate the wealth, those who ensure that everything that exists in this country actually moves in the same worldwide. And that's the worker in the countryside, the worker in the factory, the worker at the universities, the worker in schools, the worker in hospitals, the worker everywhere. We are the ones who can do it. Unfortunately, in our country, we still have a situation where there are comfortable postures held by some trade unionists, where in exchange for three or four little bits of political power which are handed out, people are bought off. We have not been able to create a broad movement in the left. We have three or four currents in the trade union movement, headed up by the corporate movement, also just three or four groupings, but we haven't been able to do what we need. But it doesn't matter. In the final analysis, the demands of the workers are being felt. We have to get busy. We cannot continue anymore to have a situation of passivity, of comfort, but we have to a situation facing us in the short, medium, and long term. And as a trade union, the STUNAM, we're involved in this. We do not tire. This new law which has been imposed, they may have imposed it today and for tomorrow, but we are going to get it abrogated. We have fought for this in the 70s and the 80s. We fought for to make sure that workers had full labor rights. And with a Congress that was 90% in the hands of the PRI, we managed to transform Article 3. So we were able to modify the Constitution. Now, this is a secondary law, and I do think that we can get it canceled, abrogated, so that the rights of workers, the constitutional rights of workers, are respected, which are today being violated by this new law. If there are any comments, I'm available. Thank you very much, and we're open to conversation.
Okay, muchas gracias.
Thank you very much,
Ingeniero Rodriguez. Después de la participación de Lyndon LaRouche,
after the presentations by Lyndon LaRouche and yourself, it's clear enough that the world needs a new world economic and financial economic order with a programmatic context along the lines of what Mr. LaRouche has also presented and proposed this morning. What I would like to do now is to open the floor for a period of questions and answers, both from our international audience and also from here in the local auditorium in Mexico City. And we see more and more people, labor representatives and others, are arriving. along with Ingeniero Agustin Rodriguez, Engineer Agustin Rodriguez, another important leader of the STUNAM, the biologist Agustin Castillo, and also Eric de León as a representative of the LaRouche youth movement in Mexico City and in Mexico as a whole. So I would like to open the floor for discussions. I have here the first question, which comes to us from Bolivia. This is a question for Mr. LaRouche and also for Ingeniero Agustin Rodriguez. The question says, as all of you know, the Bank of the South is in the process of being created in South America. What should the main obstacles that have to be overcome as South American nations to bring this about? So I would like to ask Mr. LaRouche to answer this question about the Bank of the South, and then we will ask Mr. Rodriguez to speak.
The Bank of the South is a real victory, but a limited victory. It's an essential step because it changes the character of the relations among the nations of South America. It's not perfect yet, but it is a first step and a very important step in that direction. The idea, let me go back on this thing. Back in 1982, when I was standing with a great friend of mine, the president of Mexico, López Portillo, and we had at that point assurances from the governments of Brazil and Argentina to support López Portillo in these efforts, and they under great pressure capitulated, and Mexico went into the soup as a result of that in the fall of that year. But the precedent was great. López Portillo is a hero. That has been lost somewhere in the shuffle. But he stood up with courage, and one should look at his address to the United Nations in October of that year, which is still available. And you see a statement of a patriot of his country, defending his country against a rapacity, which at that point was coming from the United Kingdom and the United States particularly. So what this represents is a line of resistance against the debt prison condition of the nations of South and Central America. The very fact that this institution has been initiated, actually with a action started from Argentina with the support of other countries, Brazil and Venezuela and so forth, and the other developments are good developments. They do not answer the question, they pose it. And they bring together a group of nations which are now in a process of discussion to try to understand the Westphalian principle. Can we, in other parts of South America, understand the problems of Bolivia? Can we understand the problems from other parts of South America in Peru? Can we understand the crisis which faces Ecuador because of the recent history? Can we understand these things? Can we make the concern about the other our primary concern, knowing that if we all agree on that, we can establish a system? So you need a banking institution, a central credit institution, backed by the constitutional arrangements provided by each nation to create a common institution whose slogan should very well be the famous Westphalian slogan, the advantage of the other, that each of us cooperate to the advantage of the other. Now, this requires an international arrangement, as has said. We have the condition, we in the United States have a special understanding, or some of us do at least, of the problems of Mexico. I'm sort of close to Mexico in many ways. But what we're doing to the Mexican population, we drive it into desperation. We drive it across our borders. We use it as cheap labor. We destroy Mexico in the process of doing that. Then we blame Mexico for attacking the United States by sending its cheap labor over to work for our companies here. It's wrong. The security of the United States over past times often depended upon the security of Mexico. Take the case of the Civil War. The British, supported by the French at that time, but the Bonaparte, over to the government of Mexico. This was an attack upon the United States. When the United States won the Civil War against the British puppet called the Confederacy, we acted, and Mexico regained its sovereignty. We have always understood, since Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, before he was president, we've always understood that the defense of the sovereignty of our neighbors is an essential part of our security. And this is the same thing for the hemisphere. The conditions of life in Mexico imposed today are a threat to the United States. They're a threat to Mexico. You have similar kinds of attempts which are being resisted in South America. So the resisting these kinds of oppressive, really colonialist methods is an essential part of the defense of each country on behalf of the other. If we understand this, and if we understand that as nations, this is the case, then we can solve the problem. The other thing is this. The other thing is the question of national sovereignty. If you do not have national sovereignty, you don't have citizenship. You are simply a peasant with no protection from a landlord. Because each of us, sometimes we have the same language with a slightly different dialect. But we have a different history. And among our ordinary people, there's a different history. Therefore, in order to govern sovereignly, we must be able, in each case, to bring our people together in some kind of functioning relationship where they can act with a united sovereign will. We have to then bring nations which each have their sovereign will, as defined in part by their cultural history and their specific history, together to understand what their common interest is as a group of nations. And to me, we are approaching an understanding of that type. It may not be settled, but we are approaching it in a discussion around the Bank of the South, which I think is extremely important. And this ties in. If we understand that the success of the Bank of the South, in terms of its intention, in South America is essential for Central America, for Mexico, and for the United States, and if we realize that we can only realize that by setting up a new international monetary system, which includes the Bank of the South, as one of its key institutions, then we are on the road to victory. So I think the Bank of the South should not be exaggerated in the sense, don't put too much blame on it for what must be done. But it is an indispensable institution at this time, and it must be defended and promoted as an indispensable institution with the intention that it should become an integral part of a new world monetary system as a whole, in which it represents its part of the world and is part of the general concern for the welfare of the other.
Thank you very much, Mr. LaRouche. Here in Mexico, from 1994 on, under the regime of Salinas that year, a supposed autonomy for the Bank of Mexico was created. It was no longer answerable to the executive branch of government, and with that, the collapse of the internal market has been aggravated by the lack of internal credit for production. The Bank of the South is, as Mr. Lurch has explained to us, a fundamental pillar to establish the first step towards creating credit for production. I would like to ask Ingeniero Agustin Rodriguez if he would like to make any comments with regard to this question. Was asked from Bolivia by Mr. Ibáñez from La Paz. Well, I think it is important for there to be an institution, an alternate institution to what we know as the World Bank,
banca inter, el Banco Interamericano
the
de
Inter-American Development Bank,
que es lo que ha propiciado
which is
el empobrecimiento,
what has created a lot of impoverishment because the credits which are issued then create circumstances where it's very difficult to repay these loans. And those loans, these credits, I don't know of any country in Latin America which is not indebted. So I think that it is important to build an alternative banking arrangement with resources that could be used, or which could be contributions could be made to it by all countries which want to have a different form of development. However, that's only one part of the problem. That's the capital side of the equation, because the other part is to encourage and to create a formula, a way of carrying out joint work where the Latin American countries, especially those that produce oil, where others produce agricultural products, that is to say, we can set up a common market which could lower the cost of living to the countries of Latin America. That's something which has been discussed. It was discussed and presented at one point by Fidel Castro. It was also discussed by Hugo Chavez, and now also the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales. And that's where we have to work. I think the idea of constructing a broad united front of trade exchange is necessary, because it's not just a question of banking. It's the other side which allows us to create a front which will allow us to renegotiate that enormous debt which all countries in Latin America have, and to encourage a different kind of economic development, completely different from the current form of development, which has only produced conditions which are beneficial to have the interests of capital have greater benefits than society in its totality.
Okay, muchas gracias, Agustín.
Thank you very much, Agustín. We would like to announce that we also have here in the auditorium the General Secretary of the Trade Union of Passenger Transportation Secretary in Mexico, Clemente Estrada. He's here with us in the auditorium, and he's here to participate in this dialogue with us. I would like to announce that in a few moments we have greetings from the Secretary General of the General Trade Union Confederation of Argentina, the CGT, as you know. This is the most important trade union confederation in Argentina. And so we want to now turn to Argentina, which, after having won an important victory in social security, we need to emphasize the great progress being brought about towards the general welfare of the society, which is being pursued by the government of Néstor Kirchner, and also coming from this important trade union base arm, which is the CGT. That will be at 1:45 from Hugo Moyano, the Secretary General of the CGT. So now let's turn to some questions from the auditorium here in Mexico City. If anyone here, any of the leaders would like to ask Mr. LaRouche or Mr. Rodriguez a question, please come forward. A moment ago, a number of people had their hands up. right after the speeches. Now, okay, here's someone. Please do come up front and tell us your name and your post. Please come up front so that you can speak into the microphone.
Soy Alfonso Flores.
My name is Alfonso Flores. I don't have a position or post. I'm just very representative of the workers, and my question is, we would like to know what's the point of view of the new ISSSTE reform laws in terms of handicapped people. What will happen to the handicapped? I would like to ask Agustin Rodriguez to please answer this question. One moment, please. Let me see if there are any additional questions first from the auditorium here in Mexico City. If anyone would like to ask a question of with regard to these two presentations which we've heard so far, please come forward. We have a member of the LaRouche Youth Movement who wants to pose a question.
Hola, buenos días.
Hello, good day. My name is Carlos Jonás of the LaRouche Youth Movement. I want to say hi to everyone in Chile, in the United States, to Mr. LaRouche, and to everybody who is listening to us internationally. What I would like to do is ask Mr. LaRouche to present a perspective of how Mexico can participate in a more direct way in the reconstruction of the world through these great infrastructure development projects which have been proposed, including this idea of the tunnel going through the Bering Strait, since sometimes it's hard for us to make the population understand how Mexico can participate in this worldwide economic reconstruction. Of course, without leaving aside all of the dealing with the neoliberal economic measures being proposed, but also in a parallel fashion, how can Mexico participate in the creation of these projects, which, as far as I'm concerned, would resolve a large part of the poverty and lack which the population of the world is facing today? So thank you very much.
Well, the answer, of course, essentially is that, as I know it, in respect to Mexico, is that what happened beginning the summer of 1982 was a process of willful, massive destruction of Mexico and its people. And this was accelerated. It was already begun then. It was begun under heavy pressure from the United States and from the United Kingdom. I fought against it. López Portillo and I got into great trouble for fighting against these forces. But the destruction, the systematic destruction of not only the welfare in terms of incomes of the people of Mexico, but the destruction of their capability, their productivity, their opportunities to produce, is such that you have a permanent damage, which you would compare with, for example, in U.S. history, with the situation in the United States after only 4 years or so under the those before Franklin Roosevelt. We had a problem in the 1930s of a population which had suffered great loss in productivity, in skills, in opportunities, in industries, and so forth. We had to rebuild. Franklin Roosevelt rebuilt. But in fact, we had a drop of the U.S. economy by about 30% from the time of the 1929 crash until the time that Roosevelt was inaugurated. These policies were not just caused then. They were caused by a longer period of measures over the whole period of the 1920s on. There were certain wars in Mexico and so forth which had an effect on this. So, and in the United States, it's only in the United States itself. Therefore, we in the United States, under Roosevelt's policies, which are the traditional American constitutional policies, rebuilt the United States. We created the greatest economic machine the world had ever known from the depths of poverty over the period into 1945, the end of Roosevelt's death. And Roosevelt had intended, had he lived, to develop the entire world on that basis by converting the war machine we had built up to defeat Hitler, to use that to develop developing countries and to give nations which had been colonial nations or semi-colonial nations their freedom to develop their future, to create a community of sovereign nation states on this planet. Now, we face a situation in the Mexican population which has two components, two principal components, inside Mexico and inside the United States. This population is in grave danger. So therefore, what we would have to do is take a project like this, the anticipation of the completion of the Bering Strait tunnel. We wouldn't simply wait until that tunnel is completed to start the operation. You would already build the adjuncts which are going to fit into it to build up the entire network of operations from Alaska through Canada in the United States and southward all the way to Tierra del Fuego. We have to now. So knowing that we are building an international system would be reason enough to build each component, not wait till one's completed before starting the next one. What we would face is a problem in Mexico. Presuming that Mexico gets back its sovereignty, and the sovereignty as existed, at least on paper, existed in principle at the time the attack on the López Portillo government occurred in 1982. We would have to rebuild. We would have to build largely with starting with infrastructure projects, long-term major infrastructure. This would mean high-speed transportation. This would mean water systems. This would mean power systems. These would have to be largely public institutions, because you don't have the private institutions which can do this on that scale. You would then use, as we did in the United States in the 1930s, for example, you would then take the poor population of Mexico, the agricultural, the rural population. You would have to have a protectionist policy to protect the Mexican jobs and protect the living standards by protectionist measures which prevent companies from dumping cheap products on Mexico to shut down their industries. You would have to create institutions to rebuild the well-being of the Mexican people, especially the Mexican poor. You would have to have reforms in education. We had these kinds of things. We tried in the United States during that period. And we continued some of these things after the war had concluded. We did create an increase in productivity per capita. We did increase the standard of living inside the United States by these internal development measures, not by foreign measures. And therefore, the same thing would apply here. We have to see the coming 50 years of the world as a 50-year initial development program. We have to envisage along all the right-of-ways of the great transportation systems, ground-based transportation systems, which are needed for this. We have to see all along these routes. We are developing the routes of development, protectionist routes of development, protection of national sovereignty, economic protection of national economic sovereignty, and thus build up the Mexican population, both that which is now working as virtual almost slave labor in the United States, and as slaves looking for employment as slaves on the south of the Mexican border with the United States. We have to change that. We have to move that in Mexico as well, but we have to be patient. We have to realize we have desperately poor throughout the hemisphere. We must understand the problem of developing a nation over several successive generations to take the immediate situation, find remedies, improve things now, move upward, over three generations. You know, when people came into the United States in the late 19th century, early 20th century, they came in from Europe. They came in three generations. Those who came in as cheap labor from Europe became the scientists, the physicians, and so forth of our economy, or not all of them, but many. We integrated the population of the United States. So then, under Roosevelt, we saw ourselves as one people, no matter what time we came into the United States. We saw the United States as a place where there were no oligarchies. Oh, we had a few from England, but not real oligarchies as in Europe. And people were glad to be in the United States, to be free of the burden of a European-style oligarchy, of the type that still dominates on the continent of Europe and the United Kingdom today. And we have to have that attitude, building the strong citizen with a sense of citizenship, with a sense of a future, over a three-generation span or a four-generation span. We have to have people who are struggling today knowing that their grandchildren will prosper and seeing their future and what they're contributing to their grandchildren, as we did then in the United States back in the 1920s and 1930s. And with that attitude, we are going to take the view of developing the entire hemisphere as part of a global system.
Okay, muchas gracias, señor LaRouche.
Thank you very much, Mr. LaRouche. I would like to, before moving on to the next step in this discussion, ask Ingeniero Rodriguez if he has any comments on these ideas posed by previous speakers.
Solamente la parte del...
Only the only on this question of workers who are handicapped, the new law doesn't deal with this at all. Here, there's no delimitation, no reduction of benefits under the previous law the same. So that's what I would say at the moment. I wouldn't want to say any further because I understand there are other presentations that need to be made.
Okay, muchas gracias.
Thank you very much.
Bueno, tenemos varias preguntas que las
we have a number of questions which we are going to incorporate in the process. There are questions from Colombia, also questions from Cajeme in Sonora, the Technological Institute there. And I also want to say to you that we are going to hear shortly from Yasmin Fariña. She is currently the vice president of the FENAFUCH, the University of Chile trade union. She has a long history of activity as a social worker for the defense of the workers, university workers, and in workers in general in Chile. As you know, Chile was the first country where the policies of privatization of Social Security were implemented. This was done by violence and force under the Pinochet regime, and from that time to the present, we see some of the results, and we would like to hear directly from Yasmin Fariña on this subject. So I'd like to ask you for a round of applause for her from Santiago, Chile. Please go right ahead. I'm speaking from Chile, and I want to speak about the damage caused by the laws on privatization. I want to thank Agustín Rodríguez and also Linda LaRouche organization for this. For 10 years, we at this university have been fighting to expose the privatized pension social security system. In Chile, the pension system was changed in a dark period of our history, which began on September 11, 1973, with a military coup. What begins is an economic system and political and social system in Chile of globalization and neoliberalism. Chile is the first country, the first laboratory of the neoliberal system to an extreme. Today we see how the concentration of economic power through the AFPs, the privatized social security funds, has been changing laws in Chile, flexibilization of labor laws. The youth of Chile don't have a future. People are being hired on a project-by-project basis, on a temporary basis. People who reach a certain age are considered to be too expensive and not efficient enough, and their years of work are not recognized. This model, which has been imposed on us, and which unfortunately in the 4 years of the concertation government we've been able to change this, 50% of the labor force is not covered under the pension social security system. That large percentage of workers, because of their low wages, will not be able to obtain any kind of a dignified pension at the moment that they retire. We find that this model does not permit people to move freely to a system where they are receiving benefits. So this is a system with no positive way out, because the current proposed reform of the Social Security legislation is simply one that will legitimize a system which was imposed on us under the dictatorship. And this is what neoliberalism has imposed here in Chile. So we've reached the extreme of privatizing everything, basic electricity, communications, potable water, education. The state is less and less involved in the economy of the country. Today, in our university, only 17% of our budget comes from the government, and the rest has to come from quote-unquote self-financing. That is to say, we have to get private funds. There's a whole number of private universities which have been created where education has been commercialized, and the gap between the poor and the richer is more and more brutal day by day. Public education as such is today, those students can't get into the public universities because the system is very bad. So the whole system, which has to do with health, today we have tremendous technologies available in communications and health, but it gets to only a very small minority of the population who have the economic resources to do this. The public health system is poor indeed. It lacks the most basic things that you might want to think of. And the workers in the health sector is being privatized as well. It's being outsourced to companies things like nutrition, nursing, the whole question of helpers and guards is now run out of private companies. Under the conditions of the AFPs, the private pension funds, this opened the market to a group of economists who are at the time progressive, who have sold all of these companies to the multinational companies. Now the Chilean AFPs no longer belong to Chileans. They are owned by multinational companies, oligopolies, and the resources are being invested abroad with great risk to us, especially based on what Mr. LaRouche has just told us. We're running a great risk with these investment of our pension funds outside the country. And even more serious is when our president, Michelle Bachelet, sent a draft legislation to the parliament which would increase the percentage to 43% that the pension funds are allowed to invest abroad. All of the losses are absorbed by the workers under this private pension fund. But these companies have had the most incredibly high profits. Today, people are not really concerned about protecting Social Security in Chile. The first victims include workers in the public sector. Public workers under the old system and who passed over to this new privatized system because they were forced to switch over. They were forced to because the leadership of this was imposed by the military. They were obligated, forced by propaganda, so that otherwise they would lose their job. These people are finding that their pensions today are not even 13% of the income that they were generating. So what they're going to get is less than 30%. This happens with architects, for example. Architects who earn $1,600,000, their pensions are less than $400,000. So for the middle class or for the middle and lower levels of public employees who have an income of 500,000, the pensions under privatized pension security is only 92,000 pesos. This is a shame that we are exporting to the world a system which is impoverishing workers, and yet economic power is being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. Another thing which is also of great concern to us, and that is how Chile has been opening its market, importing foreign products, and this is leading companies to bankruptcy. There was one company which was very powerful, employed over 1,000 people. Today, that company have gone bankrupt, and no longer exist. So how can we, in the same process of trade, all of our forests, all of our natural resources are being exported, our seas, our agriculture, are exporting raw materials, and what comes into Chile are finished products, which are purchased by Chileans. Look at how they are stealing our natural resources. So this neoliberal economic system is not helping the Chilean population. Everything that is said about us abroad is not what we are experiencing here in Chile. It is not what we have seen and know when we try to get health care, when we, under the terribly impoverished conditions that the technicians, the professionals, the nurses, the doctors are trying to function under, when at the state-run universities, the academics get only a 30% pension and become poor, and current employees is because a pension of 90,000 in Chile today is really miserable. You live in total poverty. And how our national industries have been shutting down. So we think the time has come where we have to denounce this internationally. We have had a lot of seminars, and in this regard, I really want to thank the LaRouche organization because they have allowed us to present to the world the reality of Chile, which is otherwise hidden and which the politicians themselves hide and cover up. How the government of concertation has not been able to improve this situation, to humanize it. We're today facing a reality which is really terrible, and we have drugs coming into the country. Drugs in the poorest layers of the population is really quite impressive, how a market has been created in this part of the population. These are people, this is unimaginable, the level of the crime wave as a result of unemployment and layoffs and drugs as well. There's a large number of people in who are in the labor market but who don't have work and end up in delinquency and criminal activity. I would also like to say that we have been involved in these battles for a long time, denouncing this fascist system which Pinochet left us under the decree 1300, which is stealing the future of our youth. And we're in despairing to have the idea of a reform of the health sector which did not improve the qualities of the health sector, and how the educational reform is also not improving the quality of education, of public education. And today we have, with what is happening with students, we cannot allow that our people being taken into poverty in the area of education. So today, the university is taken by the university students because they have debts and because of the high costs, they are not able to get a decent education. So that academics have had to go to private universities to increase their income. So I think this has reached a point which is not acceptable anymore in this country. They have privatized public transport. The state is refusing to take a responsible role in public transportation. So they've truly taken us to a situation which I would call a situation of despair. From despair, when our colleagues have terrible pensions, when they cannot get adequate health care that they can afford. Today, anyone who doesn't have money doesn't have good health. Anyone who doesn't have money or doesn't get indebted cannot educate his children. So I think that truly Chile is not what people say about it abroad. It has grown significantly economically, but the wealth is concentrated in a political group and an economic group. And unfortunately, those who manage communication and those who are financing the campaigns in Chile, and I say this of the politicians, but not only of the concertation group, but also of the right wing. Today, the right wing in Chile, in this country, seems more leftist than the parties of concertation itself. When some of the politicians of concertation are denouncing these policies, how our raw materials are being stolen, and how it's being taken with no taxes, these people are considered as politicians who are against the concertation itself, even though they are members of it. So I would issue a call to our president, who is a socialist, and we all placed our hopes in her. We as leaders who participated in the parties of concertation, we issue a call to her to truly reform this neoliberal economic system, which is not favoring the great majority of the population, and which will take us to social circumstances which we do not wish to recall, situations from the past. We have had lots of strikes. We have had workers in the South who have gone out on strike, where people are really facing a terrible crisis and have had to take to the streets. Less than a month ago, a worker from a forestry company died because the company refused to negotiate with the workers, so he was killed by law enforcement officers. So this worker was so despairing that he went kind of crazy, and he was killed by the police. So that's the situation that the fishermen in our Chile face as well. Is really dramatic how the oil companies, how the oil ships have dumped their oil in the ocean, and therefore the contamination has affected the fish, the birds. All of the fishermen who lived on this are today despairing. This is not known in the world. This is not known anywhere. Today that they have blocked all reality, communication of the reality that Chile is losing. I think you today have given us a space and an important opportunity, a significant opportunity to talk about this. When we asked President Bachelet, how is it possible that we have a situation with 157 workers of the state who are about to go into retirement and without adequate pension systems? These are university professors, workers, upper class, middle class, lower class, from all layers who work for the public sector, and they deserve a more dignified solution, not with 30% of their income, because they have worked and contributed for 40 years to the old system, and then they were forcibly switched over under a de facto government into the privatized system, which did not recognize all of their earlier contributions. Today, we want to provide job opportunities for the youth of today. And people who work in the public sector don't want to leave. They don't want to leave because they, and for good reason, because you, like an architect, a friend of mine, a 70-year-old woman who I always present her as an example, she worked for 11 years more than the cutoff age of 60 years, and she left with only a 40% of her salary after having contributed until she was 70 years old. So I think we have to let our reality be known internationally, and our politicians have to state with their hands on their hearts, okay, it's okay for the rich to make good money, but we also must have solidarity with our people. So we need a refounding of the social security system in Chile, which will allow the national companies to receive money from workers in order to grow, so that our natural resources are not stolen through international trade. Why should we have to buy furniture purchased abroad with wood coming from our forests? We want to have a national industry of our own. So we have a situation where we need to produce our own goods internally. We need dignified work with a worthy salary for our people. Excuse me, Yasmir, from Mexico. So we need to have social security where workers, where employers are required by law. Excuse me, Yasmir, I would like to. I think I've gone a bit over my time. Please excuse me. No, forgive me. It's not for that, but because we do want to continue hearing what you have to say. It's very important what you're saying about Chile. But we do have a second part of our discussion for this. We hope that you'll be able to stay for that discussion. I would like to simply interrupt you briefly and then continue. We have on the phone line the Secretary General of the CGT of Argentina, the General Confederation of Workers, Mr. Hugo Moyano. The CGT is the most important labor institution in Argentina, this neighbor-friendly country, and they have carried out a very important campaign and a series of activities to reverse the privatization in Social Security and other areas. So I would like to ask Mr. Hugo Moyano to please speak to us, to greet us, and also make brief remarks on what Mr. LaRouche has been saying and Agustin Rodriguez have been saying, and also Yasmin Farinha. So please proceed, Mr. Hugo Moyano. Thank you very much. I'm very pleased. I'm the Secretary General of the CGT of Argentina. And as you just correctly said, we come from a very extensive campaign, which began when the retirement of workers was privatized. I've been involved in this for many years because I'm a trucker, I'm a teamster in Argentina, and from the beginning, from when the situation began, which was created with the privatization of Social Security, we rejected this because time showed us that workers were being harmed in a really significant way by this privatization. Not only the workers who tomorrow is going to retire, but the guy who has retired now because the savings funds of the pension funds, which allowed certain funds to be available to the retired workers, have been reduced. So what we have achieved now, through many years of struggle, we have gained the recognition by the government that this system, which in recent years were governing our country, was totally damaging to the workers of our country. And this led to the modification of the law, which is what we were demanding. We didn't say that there shouldn't be private pension funds. We said that workers should actually have the option, the choice of deciding where their savings should be held, if they wanted the government to keep it, or if they wanted to go into a private fund. That was all that we were asking for. And fortunately, thank God, this has become a reality. And over this period of since 600,000-700,000 workers have on a voluntarily basis moved back into the public state pension system. So now there is a policy where this has been clarified for workers so that workers can see what the real benefits they get, either from private pension funds or public pension funds. And that's why I believe that we have so we've achieved a very important objective, and I think that we've managed to salvage the dignity of workers. I don't know what's happened in other parts of the world. I don't know if it's the same as what was happening here in Argentina. Here in Argentina, what we would say, sort of as a joke, is we would say The people could get divorced if they wanted to, but they couldn't change from one private pension fund to another one. So we said, at least let them have the choice. Don't obligate them. Don't force them, as unfortunately occurred under this evil system which existed previously of privatization of Social Security, so that they have a choice. They have an option. They either go in with the private sector or with the public sector. They have a free choice, and that's what we have achieved. And I reiterate, this is what has made it possible for what I think is now a million workers to return to the state-run pension system to manage their retirement funds. I don't know if there is anyone who would like to ask me a question or if this is sufficient. Thank you very much for your comments. We would like to very much to ask you to stay on, if you could, for our second part of our discussion. But what I want to do now is reiterate an announcement which I made at the outset. Mr. LaRouche is going to have to leave this webcast. He will perhaps have some closing remarks to make, and he will have to leave. And then I would ask, after Mr. LaRouche speaks and before Mr. LaRouche leaves, to ask Mr. Agustin Rodriguez to also have some closing words for Mr. LaRouche. So, Mr. LaRouche, we would like to have your closing remarks.
The evil that we've been discussing today so far is an evil with which I'm quite familiar from a long period of struggle, especially since the development changes of 1971, where the United States went in the direction of London-directed fascism. And what I've heard today on discussions of this and that all are reflections of things that I saw coming and happening 30, 40 years ago. And the interesting thing is, now today we discuss them, but as those of you who have spoken really know, you've been living through this kind of process for decades. You had a case like the case of Pinochet. The degradation that Pinochet represented is not understood. Here's a man who is practically a prostitute for London, and he's featured as some kind of a military hero, some kind of a figure for respect, taking, begging for favors and stealing and petty stealing through the Riggs Bank, which is essentially a part of what we're getting now with this BAA operation. He's essentially a lickspittle of the British Empire. Huh? And you see this all over the place. And we have to have a sense of this. It's important to have it, because people have to realize that what they have allowed to be done, what they have praised, what they have voted for in the United States and in other countries, this was evil. We have description today of suffering of people in Mexico, of Chile, of Argentina so far. But this has been going on. It's becoming worse. It was obvious to us at the beginning of this process, say, 1982, when the real wave of crushing of South America began. It was all there. It was there from 1971. It was clear. But people now are looking at something which has been going on for more than a generation. For most people, it's up to almost two generations of suffering of their adult life experience. And now we're looking at it. This is not just an issue of making some improvements. This is an issue of saying it is time that this kind of behavior, which we have addressed in part in a few remarks here and there today, is typical of the world situation, but especially of relations within the Americas. And we have put up with this. We have protested. For we have not treated this for as what it is, as an evil. And that sense of urgency that we must make a fundamental change in the world system now. We cannot make concessions to evil forever, because too many people will suffer if we don't change the system. The time has come where the system is coming down. And this is the time for us to put in our word for the changes which have been waiting too long to be brought on.
Thank you, Mr. LaRouche. And we're really enthusiastic about the ideas we've presented, which we will carry on in the discussion which follows after you have to leave. Before presenting, asking Mr. Agustin Rodriguez to close this session, there are in Argentina various other groupings. We have a meeting of the in Argentina, the APOPS, in an auditorium of the CGT, and the Adjunct Secretary General will join us shortly, Salvador Fernandez. Also in Lima, the Dean of the Association of Professors of Peru, Carlos Gallardo, who is also following this webcast closely. So to close out this part of the discussion and say goodbye to Mr. LaRouche, I would like to ask Mr. Agustin Rodriguez for closing remarks. Thank you very much. Only to thank Mr. LaRouche, recognize his great willingness to have this kind of exchange of views, which in the final analysis construct a pathway of transformation of this economic model which we have been enduring and suffering for so many long years. It's important that this subject of Social Security be dealt with in more detail ahead, because the discussion and the fight is not going to end soon, and that we address this in terms of the experiences which people are going through in Chile and Argentina and elsewhere, and look at the positive side of how we can construct an alternate proposal. Here in Mexico, the model which is being imposed of a new law of the ISSSTE, it has a very peculiar characteristic. It's being imposed upon workers by requirement that they accept this. The part which the brother from the CGT of Argentina was referring to is not happening here, where it was made optional or voluntary. Here, it's required and enforced. That's the scheme under the current law, and that's what has forced us to create a great political movement against this. So, Mr. LaRouche, we want to thank you very much. We will be in communication for further exchanges ahead, and we will now move on to the next part of our discussion. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Mr. LaRouche. Thank you, Agustin. And now I want to welcome Dennis Small.
This is Dennis Small, representative of LaRouche in Iberoamérica, and editor of the publication in Spanish, and he's going to be part of the discussion
Before we continue with Argentina,
I would like Mr. Small to ask to give a small presentation.
Me informa de que antes de que el señor Small ingrese, nos quedamos con Hugo Moyano para un par de comentarios adicionales. Adelante, señor Moyano.